Welcome to this week's episode of the Tech Podcast. I'm Fred Lambert, your host. And today I'm not joined with Seth right now. He was with us a second ago, but something happened, a technical error or something. So he's going to probably, I assume, join us in a few minutes. But in the meantime, I'm not alone. I'm with Mike Atoll, electric reporter for personal EVs, e-bike, e-motorcycles. And oh, we have Seth. But you interrupted my introduction to Micah, Seth. That's rude of you. No, I'm kidding. So yeah, Micah is here too. Well, first of all, how are you, Micah?
Good. How's it going, Fred?
Going fine, thank you. So Micah and I, we were at in Milan all week for the Milan Motorcycle Show. And we were there because there were supposed to be a few EVs to check out there. And we had, well, there were a lot of EVs to check out, actually. A ton of motorcycles that were electric. Really, it felt like the electric powertrain was, like, is taking over the show. And we didn't come up with, like, actual statistic, like a percentage of how many e-bikes versus gas-powered one. But it's starting to get pretty significant. So, Micah, if you've been following electric this year, you already read a bunch of posts that Micah did about the bikes coming up. There's still a... All right, Seth. There's still a ton more to go, and we're gonna talk a lot about that for the first part of the show with Micah and Seth. How about you? How are you doing, Seth? Oh, you're on the phone, internet right now. Oh, your connection looks pretty good for. That's a good ad. All right, so. We're going to start out with probably the most high-profile electric motorcycle at the show. That's mainly because of the name, because otherwise it's not on the market, doesn't exist. Harley-Davidson with the Livewire. That's something that's been in the making for years. And if I understand correctly, what we saw at the show, the new bike, is the production version, right?
Yes, it's the production prototype.
Yeah. Well, it's what it's going to look like when it's going to production next year. Pretty significant update from the original prototype that we saw 4 years ago. What did you think of it, Micah?
I was pleasantly surprised. I went in not super optimistic. You know, I was excited to see it and see what Harley came up with, but I didn't have really high hopes because I don't want this to come off the wrong way, but I kind of thought Harley was on the way out. And I was really surprised at what a nice bike they ended up building. It looks more reasonable than the original prototypes. They were, like, really futuristic, and I felt, like, a little too far out there for what would become, like, an actual mainstream consumer electric motorcycle. But they've dialed it back just a little bit, but left what I think is a really cool-looking, fairly aggressive but not crazy-looking bike. I would have loved to see more tech specs. They had a press conference all about the Livewire, and they talked about all of the motorcycle parts, you know, the brakes, the suspension, the frame, everything that Harley's real good at. That's what they wanted to talk about, but they didn't have any information yet about the motor, about the batteries, about the controller. So it sounds like they might not be all the way there yet on exactly what the electronics are and what, like, the motor package is.
You think the powertrain is not finalized? That's why they didn't announce anything?
I feel like if they knew the specs, they would have said them, because why hide it at this point? But it is really close to 2019, and so there's not a whole lot of time left to figure that stuff out. They do have that new R&D center that they started in Silicon Valley, so it could be that they're working around the clock there.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't make sense, but what did they say? They say early next year they're going to release the details in terms of pricing and start the order book, I think, and then later on in the year they're going to start the actual production?
Yeah, that's the tentative schedule. We'll see how well they stick to it.
Okay. And you can check out on Electrek, we got very close to the bike. We're able to take a bunch of pictures. You see a few of them behind me, but right now the glare is not ideal.
So they didn't say anything about the specs. Like, there was no, like, size of the engine or battery pack or anything like that. There was nothing about that.
No. The electronics, there was just nothing. They talked a lot about the motorcycle parts.
Yeah. Like you said, it might mean that they really haven't finalized the powertrain. Though we can see it clearly, like they have, like, since it's a, what do they call that, like the design, like is it considered a naked bike when you see all the powertrain in it? Is that what they call a naked bike?
Yeah, it's a little different with an e-bike, but yeah, I guess that would still be a naked bike.
So you can see where's the battery pack, you can see the electric motor at the bottom of it. So you can see they build a powertrain for it. And it's not like the original prototype of LiveWire wasn't a working prototype. They actually had a whole fleet of LiveWire. I think there's something like 80 of them that they took around the country to give some test drive and some feedback. So even though it took a long time for them to bring that thing to production, it looks like they took it somewhat seriously and they really wanted to make a nice bike. Of course, what everyone wants to know is just how fast this thing's going to be able to go and how far it's going to be able to go, because it has been somewhat of a limitation of electric bikes so far. What's the top zero right now? How far is it going? Like 200 kilometers? You know that?
I think a little more than that, actually. Yeah, the 14.4, is it 17.4 kilowatt hours now is the top one.
Yeah, I think. I think you get the 14, then you get the power bank.
Yeah, the charge tank. Yeah,
that would make sense. So we should know in the next few months, really, probably the first quarter. There were a bunch of other, because it's going to be in the higher end of the Harley's lineup. So don't expect a cheap bike here. It's going to be expensive. But Harley also talked about coming up with other less expensive electric options in the near future. So it looks like they have a bunch of other programs, EV program, rolling out simultaneously. LiveWire is only going to be the first one of them. And it's going to be in the higher end of the market, much like Tesla did when they first came on the scene. And there were a bunch of it, like a Curtis motorcycle. That's another one that's a higher end of the market, Micah?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is another interesting one that, again, like they came out with a prototype and it was like a little bit iffy in terms of whether I could see someone actually buying it. The two production prototypes they recently unveiled, they look a little bit better. I still wonder how someone's going to sit on that seat. If you take a look at that, it just does not look very comfortable. But when it comes to the tech specs, right? Yeah, it's an impressive bike from the engineering side. See, what was the torque was 145 foot-pounds of torque, 0 to 60 in 2.1 seconds. Like, that's, that's on the high end of any electric racing bike at this point. Like, even the Energica's, I'm not sure what their 0 to 60 is now that I think about it, but I mean, you're right up there. That's just almost like a dangerous amount of power to give somebody. You don't want to rent an expensive bike like that.
Oh, you have the zero here, the range of the higher end zero, the DSR, 204 miles. That's 328 kilometers. So yeah, it's higher than I thought. And how does it compare to this one? The range, 280. So it has a higher range.
Yeah, this one has a lot of batteries in it. It's impressive what they've put into this bike. The price is also going to be impressive, but you know, if you appreciate the engineering side of it, the power, the battery capacity, the torque, this is a very well engineered electric motorcycle.
Yeah, I don't even see where they could put that much batteries in it, because there's a big open space on it.
Yeah, it's really wide though.
Yeah,
it's a pretty chunky bike in the middle there.
Yeah, and I guess that's a low center of gravity, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And what did they say about the production? Do they aim to bring down production very soon?
Yeah, they're probably not going to be able to beat Harley Davidson. I think they're looking at like early 2020. Oh,
okay,
I see that. I originally, based on their original schedule, I thought they were going to beat Harley, but it looks like the LiveWire will be out first.
That makes sense. And it's probably going to be more of a limited production type of thing, limited volumes, high price.
Yeah. It'll almost certainly be more than the LiveWire.
All right. I had a Ducati here next, but I think we're going to stay in the motorcycle space for a little while. we're going to something even more expensive, probably the Arc Vector. They released that just before the show, and they made the debut on Tuesday. Very good looking bike, very aggressive, very futuristic looking, and it comes with a crazy, crazy price tag of over $100,000. What do you think of the bike, Micah?
Again, this is another one where, like, you know, the engineering is great, but you need a certain size wallet to really appreciate it. And so if you just look at the bike, it's really impressive. It's another one that just has crazy performance. This is the 0 to 60 in 2.7 seconds. Once you get below 3 seconds, like, at that point, it doesn't really matter. It's going to throw you off the bike either way. The range on this one's a little more limited. It's still pretty good at 120 miles. Like, you know, a lot of people are not going to need more than that. This is also not a bike.
Might be more realistic too. Like, maybe the other ones are not. We know, like, with bikes and the motorcycle less so, but like with e-bikes, sometimes people are a bit ambitious with the advertised range.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, these are luxury bikes. I mean, you're not taking these on cross-country road trips, you know? I mean, these are for showing off. And so I don't think you need that crazy range on a bike like this. But this is also going to be another really low production volume one. So this is definitely like a specialty, you know, collector's item kind of bike.
Mm-hmm. And they came up with a bunch of like high-tech gear to go with it too.
Yeah, that's going to be really interesting. I think the most interesting part to me is the HUD helmet that gives you all the displays right inside of the helmet. The haptic jacket is also really interesting, and it can do cool things. Like, if you have a car coming up behind you, it can, like, give you a tap on the shoulders, you know, like, which side someone's coming up on. They also talk about how it'll have, like, speakers in it, so you don't just, like, hear music, but you feel the music sort of, like, vibrating through you.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I necessarily need that, but I guess when you're selling a bike that costs was $117,000, you got to include some pretty interesting tech.
Well, I bet it's not included in the price too. You have to buy them separately, pretty sure. Yeah, I'd be surprised if it's included with that. Though the gross margin on a $100,000 bike supposedly, yeah, that seems pretty high. And there were another super bike that we saw at the show. Kymco unveiled the Super NX, which is a very different product line for the company, right?
Yeah, this one kind of came out of left field because Kymco is a scooter company. Like, that's what they've been doing for decades now, and they're great at it. They build great scooters. When I was in Israel, everyone rode Kymco scooters, but now they've gone a really different direction and come out with this super bike, which I think is awesome because it's just going to add more diversity and competition to the electric motorcycle industry. And this is an impressive bike, not just because Kymco's never done it before, but in and of itself, it's impressive. I mean, the specs on this one, it goes up to 250 kilometers per hour, so it's 155 miles an hour, I think. I mean, that's super bike territory. And the acceleration, again, I think it's 2.9 seconds 0 to 60. So all of these are, you know, sub 3 second 0 to 60 bikes. This is like, if anything, you need like special training to be able to ride these. Though that's one cool thing about the Super NX is that they include features that basically ease people into it, so that you know, they've got active control, so you're not accidentally popping a wheelie if you don't mean to. They've got the combined braking, so if you pull too hard on, you know, the rear brake or the front brake, you're not going to slide out. So they've got some nice safety features in there, which is good because this is a bike that's meant for consumers. It's not apparently it's not going to be like you know, an Energica Racing League. It's not going to be in the MotoGP. This is definitely
though it might be. heard some rumors that they were in discussion maybe with MotoGP and to make it like sort of an electric championship. But yeah, like you said, still the main market is believed to be consumers.
Right. So they're really trying to make this easy for you know, consumers to ride, and I think that's a pretty cool innovation by itself.
Yeah, though it didn't lose the clutch, though it's still like a 6-speed bike, which is unusual for an electric bike.
Well, that's the interesting thing. It lost the clutch, but it kept the gears, right? So, like, you keep the – it's got the 6-speed transmission, but it's got a slipper clutch. So you don't actually have to, like, pull a clutch. You just use your foot to shift, which, again, like, it opens up the door to people that aren't necessarily, like, super skilled racing bike riders, which I think is neat.
Yeah.
You know, I could ride this. I'm not a racing bike rider.
And in terms of availability, they were very hush-hush on that. Like, they said it's very much just a prototype right now. And they didn't give any timeline at all or any pricing indication, right?
No timeline, no pricing. We even tried. We actually got some decent FaceTime with the Kymco chairman. And so we were peppering him with questions. And the one thing that he couldn't really tell us was how much it's going to cost and when it's going to come out. So we're going to have to wait and see on that one.
Yeah. And of course, we're also looking forward to them bringing more, because they're just starting now over the last year to bring more electric vehicle in their lineup, mainly with their scooters. And it's still not available in North America, but looks like it might be coming soon.
Yeah, definitely.
Those I like too, like the Super Soco. We didn't even know about them, right? Before that, they showed up in Milan.
So they had two previous light electric motorcycles. They were sort of like on the border between scooters to motorcycles, but they weren't available in North America, and they're sort of have limited availability in Europe. So they weren't so much on the radar yet. But the new bike that they just released, the TC Max, is a really interesting place in the market, because it's kind of below a Zero motorcycle and above like the city slicker, 40 mile an hour electric motorcycle. So I think this one's a really interesting bike, because it'd be a good way for people to get into electric motorcycles that aren't quite ready to invest in a Zero. This is going to cost
€4,500, I think it starts.
Okay, yeah. So it's really affordable for what it is. I mean, this is a 60 mile an hour, 100 kilometer an hour electric motorcycle, and it's got decent parts. It's got the Brembo brakes. It's got nice suspension. This is not like a toy motorcycle. You know, it's not a cheap motorcycle. This is a very nice vehicle, and it's
You can compare it to my Surround. When I bought the Surround, it cost me $5,000 US for the Surround, so that's about the same price. And the specs are kind of lower than that, and it's very much more of a off-road vehicle. Well, it's actually just an off-road vehicle officially. Then this one, which is equipped to be on the road, then you can, they're looking to get, they're going to have this year, or next year, it's coming out next year, EU certification, and then they're working for the one in the US. So I have to do that myself for the Surround, and I have to modify it myself in order to make it the road legal. This thing is like ready to go. And they have the two lower powered one if you are just wondering, because technically, like I said, you can go on the highway with that stuff, but it's very limited. They have it's one like,
it's borderline highway. Yeah.
You have one that's more, a lot more clearly for urban driving, and they look pretty cool too, and they are even cheaper, of course.
Yeah, these are the two that are already available in Europe, and from what I've heard, people are very happy with them. I thought they were limited to 45 kilometers per hour in Europe, but I actually learned from one of our commenters that in the UK, the TC is not limited, so that one actually goes up to 70 kilometers per hour. In the UK. So that's a really nice city bike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm trying to see the pricing. Oh, yeah. It start at... Well, the TS is €2,800, and the TC, with the difference, is just the motor, I think, the difference? No, the pack's...
It's got a little higher motor, a little bit more battery, and I think it's got a little higher torque. So all the specs are just a little bit higher, basically.
Yeah, and it's €500 more, at €3,300. So very affordable, and it can get you around the city looking a lot. Well, it's subjective, but I think it looks a lot better than the average scooter.
Yeah, I think they're nice looking. They're not as nice in terms of components as the TC Max, but these also are not like, you know, a cheap Chinese, you know, pocket rocket kind of toy. These are decent bikes, and so I would happily ride one of these around if they were available in the U.S.
Yeah, and what they were saying about that was they just started the process. They started the process last year for the TC and TS in the U.S. to get a certification, and they weren't clear on the actual timeline when they think it's going to come, and they said that they are in the process in Europe for the TC Max, and it's going to come. They're going to start the process in the U.S. soon, too. Did I get that right?
Yeah.
Ducati came up with their electric mountain bike, which costs more than the motorcycle that we just talked about, right?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a Ducati, so it's got to be expensive, right?
Yeah,
this one was, this is also a very nice vehicle. So Ducati didn't design this by themselves. They're working with Thok e-bikes, which already has a similar line of e-bikes. But basically they made this upgrade, and then Ducati did the styling. And so you get what's already a very nice electric mountain bike combined with, you know, the styling department and the skills that, that Ducati brings to it. And, you know, for someone that likes the Ducati name, you get that on the side as well. I don't know how important that is to some people, but, you know, if you're a big Ducati fan, then that's a plus. But this is a very nice mountain bike. One thing that we learned when we were at Interbike, we did a lot of outdoor demos where we were doing downhill mountain bike riding on, you know, these crazy trails with berm turns and jumps and switchbacks, and we really saw the difference between these types of, you know, like the Fox Float suspension and just like a Springer fork or something like that. And so it's an expensive bike, but it's got all of the components that someone who actually rides these mountain bikes hard would need. So this is another one that, like, yeah, it's expensive, but I think it's probably worth the price if this is your sport.
Yeah, because if you were to remove like the premium that come with the Caddy, do you know any mountain e-bike on the market that have similar specs and similar quality of components?
I'd say sort of the two similar ones that, that we have experience with here at Electrek would probably be the Bulls and the High Bike. I think Seth was also riding the High Bike at Interbike in Reno, so I think he got the full experience.
What did you say,
Seth? That thing was awesome. It, like, barreling down hills, it's just amazing.
Okay. And in terms of pricing, what are we looking at compared to that? What did we say the
it's like a $5,000 bike.
It was like $8,000, something like that?
Yeah, I think that the High Bike was like a $5,000 or maybe $6,000, which is crazy when you think about, you know, a mountain bike that costs $1,000 more than a full-fledged motorcycle that we just looked at. But that's what components cost.
Yeah,
and that's the thing. Like, in these types of sports, if you're going to do that kind of extreme riding, you need the parts that are going to keep you safe while doing it. And those are expensive parts. This is a pay-to-play kind of sport.
That were all the posts that I included for the podcast. But there were tons of other EVs that we saw there at the Milan show. I mean, really, like we felt like a wave is coming over the two wheel segment, and just a bunch of things are being electrified right now. I know that you're planning another post that's gonna sort of like everything that that we discussed about, like, were the main thing that were launched there, and so we made separate posts for them. But I know you're preparing like a long post with a bunch of different stuff in there, either not something big enough that's for its own post, or something that wasn't completely new, but it was like new for us because we were at the show. Is there anything you want to talk about right now ahead of the posting it? Or
I don't want to spoil it too much, but I think probably for each individual article we had, there are probably two more things that we were like, oh, well, we'll include this one in the compilation post. So everything from like smaller electric scooters to luxury electric scooters, neighborhood electric vehicles, electric bicycles. There's just a lot more cool stuff that we couldn't do an individual post on, but in the next day or two, we'll have that compilation post of.
Yeah, keep an eye out for it. All right, we're going to move on to Tesla real quick, starting with the new chairman. Tesla's got a new chairman. As you know, if you've been following the saga between Elon Musk, Tesla, and the ACC. With the settlement over the comments that Musk made about the funding secured with the take private deal that eventually failed, ECC forced Musk to step down as chairman of the board, and he had to be replaced within 45 days, something like that. And the board already appointed the new chairman or associate chairwoman, or just chair, I think it's the correct word, just to say chair, Robin Denholm. Denholm, I think I pronounced it correctly. She's been on the board for a while now, like for 4 years. She's an Australian executive. When she joined Tesla 4 years ago, she was mainly known as one of the top execs at Juniper Network. Since then, she moved to Telstra, not to be confused with actual Tesla. And she's actually stepping down from her executive...
Juniper Network. Oh,
someone is having some feedback.
Since then, she moved to...
Is it me or no? No, okay. All right. So she's going to be full-time chairperson at Tesla. So there's a few interesting things here. First of all, she, aside from the two independent board members that were added last year, she, in terms of the more long-time board member at Tesla, she was definitely the most independent one of the gang. Like, she was the one that didn't have like a past with Elon Musk, whether as a friend, as a family member, or as a longtime investor like Steve Jurvetson or Antonio Gracias and all those people. So that should probably be a good thing for the SEC, like if you want to tame like their relationship with the SEC.
I mean, if you look at it that way, she was probably the only one that the SEC would accept. You know, I'm sure...
Except for the two new ones.
Johnson and Murdoch. Yeah. But you know, it didn't sound like Elon was too happy about Murdoch being named since he publicly on Twitter said, no, that's not happening. But, you know, she's been with the board for a while and she's not like... Her last name isn't Musk, and she hasn't invested in Elon. So that's probably...
As far as we know.
As far as we know at this point. And she seems fine. She seems, you know, very professional. You know, Telstra is like the biggest carrier in Australia. They're like the AT&T of Australia. So she definitely has some technology experience. And, you know... There's some stuff coming down the pike from SpaceX in terms of communications, technology with that Iridium thing. So that might come in handy later on.
Yeah, there've been some talk about Tesla maybe using that technology, but that's just been rumor so far. Yeah, I mean, like I've said when that first came up that Elon is gonna have to step down from chairman. I think the most important part, because the chairman is officially the top-ranking person at a company, like they oversee the board, and the board oversee the management team. So even though Elon remains CEO, you could say in a way that Denholm is now his boss, really. I think the most important part is that the chairperson is really on board with Tesla's mission, which is to accelerate the advent of sustainable energy. Because normally... The chairperson, the board looks after the investors. Looking after the investors means that you make sure the company is profitable, is a good offer a good return on investment, which is an important part for Tesla too. Even though, like I said, that mission should come first, and the mission doesn't necessarily go with the board as responsibility toward investors. But it comes at a perfect time because Tesla just made a first profit, and Musk was is guiding for Tesla to be profitable going forward. So the missions are starting to align a lot. It's just that for a long time, there's been some talk among Tesla investors about, are we okay with Tesla not making profit and losing more cash if it means growing faster, and growing faster means more pressure on the industry to electrify faster, more pressure on the electricity utilities to incorporate more renewable energy. And like in the long term, like we keep losing cash right now, but with other investment, other capital raise, we can still survive. Or we aim to be profitable faster and then just use those profit to maintain the growth at the lower pace, of course. It looks like they choose the second option, right?
Well, I don't think they're going to go straight for profits. I think they're they want to be positive. Like, they want to be in the black. They want to pay off their loans. But I don't think they're going to put all their money into dividends or anything. They haven't announced a dividend or anything. So
I don't think dividends on my head, but
yeah. So I think they're kind of splitting the middle. I think they're going to be cash flow positive. They're going to be in the black quarter to quarter for the most part. And I think that's kind of what's going to guide them in terms of investment. Like we're making a ton of money on the Model 3. We're not going to give it all to investors, but we're going to we're gonna break even for the quarter, and we're gonna invest a bunch of the profit into new, growing.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, and they are also like using alternative ways now than not just raising more capital in order to finance their growth plan. Like the Gigafactory 3 in China is the best example. I mean, that's gonna be a huge investment. It looks like they are making deals with local banks, so they are borrowing money instead of raising capital to. Make it happen.
Right. And Tesla's always done the, like, put $1,000 down on the car you're going to get in 2 years. I can see them continuing to do that.
Yeah. That's been a good source of cash for a while, even though it's a liability at the same time. So we have a new chairman at Tesla. That's fun. Another thing that was big this week, I think, was Tesla Energy had a big week, in my opinion. First, we saw this new, it's called a power bank, using Tesla power packs to create some sort of a community energy storage system. We already, if you've been following the solar market, you might be already familiar with community solar, which is instead of having some sort of residential solar on your own rooftop, generating your own energy and then sending the excess back to the grid, which your neighbor could also use. They do sort of a smaller commercial size, well, bigger than residential, but smaller than like utility scale project that powers a whole neighborhood. And the neighbor, the ratepayer of the electricity grid in the neighborhood, they pay into the system, but they get the energy back. So you get to use direct solar without having to install solar on your home. And we know sometimes it's just not ideal for some whatever reason, whatever logistical reason on your own house. It might not make not sense. It might not make sense to have a solar around your rooftop. Now they're making sort of a similar thing, but with energy storage. They deploy just a small 2-power pack system with an inverter. And the electric utility is making a deal where, let me get the details on the deal here. There's 52 families in the neighborhood that pay that. Can participate and to use the energy storage capacity on the system. And those family, though, that's a little weird. So we said it's a community. It's like community solars, but those people don't have community solars. They have their home solar installation at home. So there are people that would normally need more energy storage because they have some excess power from their home solar installation. And they can use the system for $1 per day. So like I said, it's two power packs, so it's 420 kilowatt hour system, and these split them between 52 families. So each family basically have a 8 kilowatt hour capacity that they can access. So for $1 per day, they can access that 8 kilowatt hour capacity. And that makes sense for them because that adds up to 12.5 cents per kilowatt hour. And the electricity rates there on the average is 28 cents. And that's just the average. So normally what you're going to do with that excess power is going to use them back when the rates are higher. So, and we've seen rate in Australia go as high as like 50 cents a kilowatt hour, something like that. So there's money to be made there and no initial cost. I mean, we know that because the alternative to those people would be to have a Powerwall or whatever equivalent home and energy system from a competitor. And those come with high cost to start with, like a high startup cost. This one is $1 per day. That's it.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what scale does. It, like if somebody's having a party and they need a lot of energy one day, then they use a little bit more, and then somebody else is on vacation and they use a little bit less. So it kind of evens out. So overall, they're paying a lot less than they would individually. Also, there's one point of failure, or, you know, one mechanical point of failure at the battery. So there's theoretically fewer problems with that thing. It makes sense for small communities. You know, it's kind of like having a reliable grid system. And, you know, Australia is kind of the perfect place to demo this stuff because energy is really expensive. There's plenty of sun, so they have lots of good solar. And they have some really good infrastructure. They just are a long distance away from, you know, because they're so spread out, they're a long distance away from power plants, which are usually pretty dirty and peaker-ish. And they run on gasoline and oil and whatever.
Yeah, that's for sure. And yeah, like you said, solar is very popular there. It's the higher penetration of solar and in any country out there. Residential solar. Utilities haven't been that much on board, but that's a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, and these things kind of give you them freedom from the utilities. So if the utility says, well, you know, we don't like...
Well, the utility owned the system in this
right,
case, though.
But, I mean, this kind of idea gives them the, you know, like, if the utilities weren't putting these in, they could put them mm-hmm. in themselves.
Yeah, for sure. I think, so that's the first time, maybe that exists somewhere else, but that's the first time we hear about sort of a community energy storage system like that. So yeah, it's going to give ideas to a lot of people. I mean, I think electric utilities should like get on board with that and deploy that somewhere else. But yeah, I mean, I don't know how the logistic will work, but I think some other communities could just like deploy something similar without directly having to do with the grid. Like if within your communities you see enough people having regional solar system, you can like get together, draw up like a LLC or something and just deploy a power pack, and the whole community could just from that go off grid, really. The other big thing about Tesla Energy this week was the PG&E project was officially announced, the Moss Landing substation that we talked about earlier this week, this year, when PG&E submitted the project to the California Public Utility Commission. Now it's been officially accepted by the commission, and it means that the world is getting not one but two new biggest batteries on Earth. The battery system, like combination of batteries, they are deploying at the Moss Landing, which is like an hour south of the Bay Area, I think. And PG&E is the biggest. If you don't know, PG&E is the biggest electric utility there. 300 megawatt, 1.2 gigawatt hour project from Dynergy. Oh, did I misspell that? No, okay, no, that's the name Dynergy. I thought it was Dynergy, but that would make more sense. Dynergy. And the other one is Tesla. Tesla Energy is getting PG&E basically placed an order for a Tesla Energy project, Tesla Power Pack project of 182.5 megawatts and 730 megawatt hour. And as we reported earlier this year when the project was first talked about, they could go push that up to 1.1 gigawatt hour. So Tesla has been teasing a potential for a 1 gigawatt hour Tesla Energy project for a while. So that could be it, really. And yeah, I mean, that's something that like the energy storage market grew so fast, so quick, because I mean, no one talked about using lithium ion as Tesla Energy project like 4 or 5 years ago until like Tesla Energy came on the scenes in 2015 that Tesla Energy was launched. And at the launch, I remember Elon Musk unveiling the power pack and saying, oh, that's a complete modular solution. You can go do project from 100 kilowatt hour to 1 gigawatt hour. And like the first, all the first project that were announced were like a few megawatts. And no one really saw a 1 gigawatt hour coming. Like, didn't seem really realistic at that point. Only Elon saw it coming. And sure enough, 3 years later, there's one, maybe 2 gigawatt hour projects being announced. One of them, Tesla. And yeah, so as part of that project, there are 4 different ones. Like we talked about the Dynergy one, the Tesla one. There's 2 others, smaller one, 7 megawatts and 10 megawatts. They're all going to come online by the end of 2020. PG&E is only buying the capacity storage of each of the system, instead of other than for the Tesla project, which they're going to buy outright from Tesla, which is interesting. It's going to be a very expensive project. I don't know. I didn't make the math, but
I'm sure they got a discount on it.
for the size.
You know what's kind of interesting? I'm looking at this thing in the lead image. You know, it's only guarded by a fence, and each of those packs is, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. I mean, what's stopping some, you know, rogue group of just like backing up a flatbed over the thing and disconnecting like 5 or 6 of those and just putting on the flatbed? I mean, that's like, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of batteries.
I mean, I think that's the Australian project, the picture.
Okay. But still.
So that's in the middle, like the middle of nowhere, like a few hours north of Adelaide, yeah, in Australia.
It's like Mad Max.
I think the cost of bringing them there was the biggest cost of the project, really. No, I'm exaggerating. But yeah, I mean, that would be like a very complex heist, I think. But yeah, you're right, though. There's a lot of value in that picture. So I don't know. But so 730,000 kilowatts, kilowatt hour, basically. And I think the lowest they were talking about was 200. So just in batteries, it's probably going to be between 150 and 200 millions, I think.
Right.
That new project. And that's just a battery. So, I mean, I had the inverters in there, had all the construction costs, I had everything. I mean, it's going to be a big project. And that's one of 4 that PG&E. So PG&E is going all in on the battery system. And they say that those projects are going to replace 3 peaker plants, 3 gas powered peaker plants that they were that they have. So
that's really good.
They're going to be able to retire
those. Those are the worst. They're the mm-hmm. least efficient. They put out the most fossil fuel waste and most carbon per watt. And they're, you know, they pollute the neighborhoods around them.
Yeah. So big week for Tesla Energy. Tesla Model 3, real quick. The key fob. We've been talking about the key fob for weeks. It's here now. It's on Tesla's website. I think, as of this morning, it was sold out, so no luck for that. But probably going to go back online a few days, a few weeks. $150. But the surprise this week, so we've been talking about it for a while. We thought we didn't renew everything about it except the price. Now we know the price, $150. But Tesla on the website says that passive entry doesn't work with the Model 3 key fob. So, I mean, in the post, well, some people were speculating it's because it's working with Bluetooth, but I don't get it because the new Model S and X key fob are also working with Bluetooth, and you can have passive entry with them.
Maybe it does both.
What do you mean?
Maybe the Model S and X is Bluetooth, but it also does another RFID thing.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. Okay, I get it. Yeah, maybe. I don't know, but... I mean, that my understanding why people, because I wouldn't buy it. I wouldn't spend $150 with that because I'm happy with the way my phone works for entry. It works perfectly all the time. I know, I use an iPhone. I know some people with some Android phones says that might be a problem, might be their Android version or the way it works with some specific Android versions.
Actually, you know what's interesting is I figured out my problem is because we have two. If my phone is on the Model X, it won't open the Model 3.
That's right. So, I could have told you that. I thought you knew that.
No, I mean, like, it's just something you have to think about because, like, if, you know, I was checking what time my wife was going to be home. And then I walk up to the Model 3, you know, a couple hours later, I'm like, oh, crap, why doesn't this work? Then I have to go into
the app. So what Seth is saying is that if you're on your phone, so, like, right now I'm on my Model 3.
Right.
If I walk up to my car and my app is on the Model 3, even if my app is not open, the last car that was on my app was the Model 3, then it's going to be connected to my car. But if I switch car and I'm on my Model S, so right now it's trying to wake up my Model S and connect my Model S, then if that was the last car that I'm opening, and if it shows that on my app, even though my app is closed, then it won't automatically plug to it. I need to go back to my app. But that makes sense because normally, like, it's not like you're supposed to switch car like multiple times a day. But your example was good, Seth, though, what you said about like checking your other car, like if you want to track it. You're spying on your wife, Seth?
Yep. I'm trying to figure out when dinner's supposed to be ready.
But I don't think that's most people's complaint because a ton of people are complaining and most people don't have multiple Tesla. So I don't think that's your first world problem. So,
yeah.
My honest thing is that some specific Android that was an issue with them, but their issue is that they have to take your phone out, their phone out and click the app to be able to enter the car, which is the same thing as like taking your key fob out and clicking on the key fob to open it. So what they wanted with the key fob was passive entry, just like you get on your Model S or your Model X with a key fob. But now they're coming out with it and it doesn't have passive entry. So I really don't see the value in it. But then I said that in the post and it went sold out real quick. So I mean, looks like I'm not, I'm the only, a bunch of other people think that there's a lot of value in it.
You know what would be kind of cool is if you know how the key card opens if you put it on the side? It would be cool if you could set your phone to be the key card. You know, like an NFC tag, and just put your phone on the A pillar.
Yeah,
I don't know if that's something that they could do software wise, but that would be beneficial.
Because the value of the key card is it like if your phone doesn't work though, that, right. That's the value. Like if something happens to your phone,
or if it's dead.
There like if your phone is like broken, like it doesn't power up, the NFC wouldn't work, right?
Right.
Like this.
Yeah, so that doesn't really help. It would just be easier sometimes.
Well, it would be something that you could add, but I think like the main value of the key card is that, other than like giving it to a valet or something, but then you wouldn't give your phone to a valet.
No.
Something that the people mentioned in the comments, though, I thought was interesting. Salmon, you can use Salmon with your phone with the Model 3, or you can use it with the, Model S, you can use it with the phone or with a key fob. So with Model 3, you couldn't do with the key fob because they weren't on. Now with the key fob, you can use someone with that instead of your phone. And some people said, like, for example, in their parking garage, if they don't have, like, phone reception or something, that doesn't work. So they can use a key fob instead. That's a little bit of value to it, but I don't know. It's $150. The other thing with the... Oh, yeah. Model 3... with a different plug was spotted in Europe. So as you know, Tesla has different plugs in different markets. European market has the Type 2 Mach-E. Bunch of Model 3s already in Europe. That's not new. I mean, people imported a bunch of them, but they were imported as American version with the standard Tesla proprietary American plug. This car was spotted. A bunch of picture was shared on the Facebook German Tesla group. And because it was a Tesla Grohmann in I think it's next to Prüm, something like that. Tesla's a automation group in Germany that when they acquire Grohmann Engineering. And it's clear that it doesn't have the same plug. It's not the American plug. The handle is different. It's on what looks a standard European Tesla wall connector, which has to be Type 2. So it's fairly clear that that's a type 2 model 3. Probably the first ever spotted ever. First time we saw it. And it's in Europe. So that's interesting because the launch is not expected until January. Or the timeline as we understand right now, by the end of the year, Tesla opens order in Europe. Start in January. And then a month or two, like as usual, because it's in California, it has to go to Europe. A month or two later, it's going to be in Europe. So first car is there. Probably an engineering car that they're testing. Track mode. It's being launched. It was launched yesterday.
Did you get it?
I already have it. That was the fastest update that I ever get in terms of being announced and being in my car. I think it was announced like, and an hour later I had the update, which is pretty rare. Though it's the least useful update to have quickly because you need to get to a track. And we didn't reserve a track yet, but we're going to have to test that thing because it looks a lot of fun. Costs a lot of rubber though, but still cool. And with the release of the update, Tesla explained in detail how it works and everything. But no big surprise here. We already knew about most of it, like the stronger regen or the new torque rotation that you can adjust with the vehicle dynamic controller. The cooling, they have a track focus cooling. Apparently, you can have requires more power, but the track is more useful. And then, adjusted cornering where you can. I mean, the big thing about track mode is that you can easily drift with the car. That's the main thing, really. But, what I was disappointed about is that Elon said it was going to be you're going to be able to configure it yourself. It's going to be an open system. It doesn't look open right now. So I don't know, maybe there's going to be a further upgrade to it. But for the moment, it doesn't look like you just activate or turn it on and off. There's no configuration for it. Yes, and with the update, with the track model update, there was also, if you didn't have the Model 3 key fob support in the software, it came with it too. Jaguar got its official APE range at 234 miles.
Seems kind of low for, 90 kilowatt hour battery?
Yeah, it seems kind of low. I mean, there was a lot of weird speculation about the Jaguar's range because they've been talking about at first they were talking about 300 miles, but then people are all saying, of course, they were talking about that when the NEDC was still a standard in Europe. So everybody was like, 300 miles is going to be bullshit. It's not going to be close to that. Then the WLTP standard came out and they had the 292 miles on the WLTP, which is pretty close to 300 miles. But no one was getting close to that. A bunch of range tests were showing closer to 230 to 240 miles. And sure enough, the EPA is 234 miles. But they did ask the EPA to reduce the number, so they could have advertised it higher than that. But I don't think that, for Tesla, for example, when we talk about the way they lowered the rear-wheel drive one on the long range, in order, they did it mainly to be able to advertise all the same range with the performance version, the all-wheel drive version. I don't think that's the reason here because they don't have any other version. It's more about they likely think that it's closer to the real-world range, so they want to be more accurate, which is fair. But then a bunch of people started speculating, why is it just 234 miles with a 90 kilowatt battery pack when you can look at a Model 6 back in 2016 where they also had 90 kilowatt pack and dual motor because the Jaguar Outpace is dual motor. And that car had 257 miles of range EPA on the same test. So that's more than 20 miles difference.
And Tesla is a much bigger car. It's a significantly larger car.
Yeah, so the only explanation really is the aerodynamic. The I-Pace is definitely less aerodynamic than the Model X, but like you said, it's also smaller.
The wheels, so, I don't know what they tested with wheels-wise, but I don't know how aerodynamic or what kind of rolling resistance those wheels have as well. they seemed a little, the ones I drove seemed very off-road centric.
Yeah. They weren't optimized for the rolling distance.
Right.
I don't know. I'm not really familiar with the wheels option on the I-Pace. But yeah, so that was kind of disappointing.
It's still plenty of range, as you said in the post. And
yeah,
you know, QZ or Quartz or whatever, they did a couple of interviews with Jaguar, and you know, they had the same kind of questions. And I thought it was interesting that they were so kind of appalled by how many fewer miles I-Pace had than Tesla. And it, you know, it is an interesting question because, you know, if you look at the two vehicles, the I-Pace is almost closer to the Model S than the Model X in terms of interior size, in terms of, you know, height. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, what real world miles come out of those things.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, Quartz was about the Carnegie Mellon. They came out with a paper, like, or at least a blog or something, from a professor there that was questioning the range of the I-Pace because of like the difference with the Model X and other vehicles on the market. But yeah, the bunch of, like, he was speculating on a bunch of reason why, including like them having like a huge buffer capacity that you couldn't access.
Right.
But then Jaguar responded to that and was saying, yeah, we have a buffer, but it's a pretty reasonable buffer, like 5 kWh.
Yeah, which it was very PR, but it did seem like that wasn't the case.
Yeah, they tried to rebuff a few of the professor's speculations.
Although you know, Tesla does, you know, throw in that extra 10% for trips that they, you know, offer you. Like, for instance, we're going to Ohio tonight, and I'm charging it all the way up, and I only do that on trips. But I don't know if Jaguar. I mean, I know Chevy with the Bolt doesn't do that. I don't think Jaguar has that option either. So maybe they just don't have that extra 10%. I don't know.
But what do you mean, extra? Like, you just mean charging up to?
Yeah, you know,
you suggest you not to charge.
Yeah, that on the Model S and X and 3, you get the daily charge.
Well, but that's a recommendation. Yeah, it's not like they are hiding the power.
No, it's absolutely. But you know, theoretically, you want to keep, like, I'm leasing the Model X, so you know, I should probably just charge it up fully every night. But you know, if you own the car, you want the battery pack to last as long as possible, so you don't necessarily want to charge it up to trip mode every night. But maybe Jaguar is just like, you know what, we're never going to let our customers go all the way to the top. We're just going to have them, you know, wherever they're at, you know, 10%. We're going to keep that 10% buffer off the range. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, they have that buffer too, like they said, but it's limited to like 5 kWh, which it might be a little bit more than like a Tesla. But Tesla also has that buffer that even with the full 100% range, it doesn't, like, it still has a few, like, normally that's like 3.something kWh of full capacity versus usable capacity. But yeah, so that. But I think the aerodynamic is probably the bigger reason why they have so low range in term. Little range, well, little efficiency in terms of distance per kilowatt hour of capacity. Lastly, I'm going to hand again. I think we ended on Faraday Future last week too, on a sad note, and another one this week because things are getting even sadder. The factory in what's it called?
I would just say California.
Yeah, it's somewhere in California, somewhere between San Francisco and Los Angeles. I forget the name. Hartford, I think, in Hanford. Anyway, it's a factory that they bought like 2 years ago when their plan for the one in Nevada fell through. It's a smaller one, a smaller production, but it seems to actually be going well. They were able to build the first pre-production cars. Things were going well, but now they fired like half the staff, and they put the other half on furlough. And they don't have work at least for the next 2 months, and that's if they find investors in the next 2 months. And not only that, we had sources that said that they were auctioning some equipment there, some machinery. So it's not only like the plans are like on hold until they can get investment. The plans are also rolling back because they have to sell some equipment, so they're gonna have to order new equipment if they ever get new investments. So if if Faraday Future doesn't die in the next 2 months, their plans are definitely delayed by a lot more than 2 months, I think. And other departures. We talked about Nick Sampson last week. We talked about Mr. Savagian. Now, Dag Reckhorn, who you might also know from Tesla, manufacturing executive for Tesla that joined Faraday Futures a few years ago. He was the number one guy for manufacturing. He was the number one guy behind that factory in California. He also quit last week. So, not looking well for Faraday Future.
Hopefully they get bought by somebody with deep pockets. Ford just bought a scooter company. Maybe they want to buy an electric car company. Or maybe Apple wants to supplement their car stuff. Google could be an option. Maybe Mazda. You know, they don't have any EV plans at the moment.
Yeah. But a few options out there. I don't know what... It wouldn't make sense. I'd be happy to see that because I think they still have some good technology there and they have some good people. But, I mean, there's clearly something fundamentally wrong there because, I mean, the EV space is primed for great growth. There's space for new players. They had a ton of money. They had over $1 billion to spend on things. And, like, they ran out of money, like, 3 or 4 times already. So, I mean, there has to be some mismanagement here somewhere. So, if someone with deep pockets want to buy them, they probably need some big cleanup here. And I haven't been following Faraday Future as closely as I was like last year when I knew a lot of the people there. Now, a lot of those people left, so I don't have as many sources at Faraday Future as I used to. But I think the problem comes from the top. Jiayu Ting is probably the main issue, and he has a big grasp on the company. So if some big player, like you said, like Apple or Ford wanted to get their hands on it, I think their condition would be that... YT needs to step down, and I don't think he's prepared to do that because it's his little baby, and he had two babies, and the other one already died with the Netflix of China, Lico. Like, he already lose his grasp on Lico.
Yeah.
So he got a divorce on that, and the wife got Lico.
Oops.
And now he has Faraday Future, and he's about to either Faraday Future dies or you lose custody of it. So I think you might prefer to see it die, maybe. I don't know. Like, I'm speculating right now. But it looks like it might be that kind of deal.
Yeah, but the people who he owes money to would probably rather see it sold off in pieces. So
yeah, Evergrande. But Evergrande has still a minority stake, I think, in the company. So I think Yu Ting still has the vote here, the main vote. I don't know, but there's a GoFundMe right now campaign for the employees of Faraday Future who were furloughed. It's a sad thing, but maybe they still have a chance if the company raise some money in the next 2 months. All right, so that's pretty much it for us for this show this week. Thanks for tuning in on YouTube and your podcast app. Thanks for Micah for joining us on the show, and stay tuned for his roundup article about everything that we saw at the Milan show. Should come out later this weekend. Definitely. Thanks, Seth, for co-hosting as usual, even though you were late because of your internet. But big thumbs up to AT&T for keeping you on the show with your phone connection. And we're going to see you next time, same time next week. Bye-bye.